What's up, everyone, and welcome to the weekly edition of ESG Now, where we cover how the environment, our society, and corporate governance affects and are affected by our economy. I'm your host, Mike DiSebato, and it's Climate Week. So in addition to the ESG Spotlight we put out on Tuesday about forecasting climate risks, today we are going to discuss four massive tech companies' pledges to reduce their carbon footprint. And then we discuss the recent reporting by BuzzFeed News and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists on a cache of financial intelligence reports that show that five global banks moved illicit cash for corrupt individuals and criminals even after being fined by the U.S. authorities. Thanks as always for joining us. Stay tuned. So it's Climate Week in New York City, and usually, pre-COVID, it was a time when people and companies around the globe would gather to promote their climate agendas and talk about what we are or aren't doing to slow climate change. Since the in-person part of Climate Week ain't happening, I thought today we could look at four of the largest tech companies, Facebook, Alphabet, Apple, and Microsoft, or FAM as I'll cringingly call it, and discuss whether their proposed low-carbon plans are actually worth a damn, and so should be paid attention to by investors. To do that, I talked to Bruno Royce, who is part of our climate risk team, because Bruno did some analysis on FAM's emissions and broke them down for me.
Here we see that for all of those companies, the vast majority of their greenhouse gas emissions are in their value chain, what we call Scope 3 emissions. And in comparison, their operational emissions, what we call Scope 1 and 2 emissions, are quite small.
I'll give you an example, Apple. According to our data, Apple's Scope 1 and 2 emissions are about 64,000 metric tons per year. Its Scope 3 emissions, as reported by the company, are about 25 million metric tons. That's because Scope 3 emissions consider your supply chain, how your products are disposed, basically everything that is outside your operational emissions. Scope 3, for example, accounts for what you're going to do with your old iWatch after you trade it in for the newer version Apple just released. So when companies make targets, if they ignore their Scope 3 emissions, they are ignoring a majority of their emissions in general.
So it's interesting to see that, for example, Alphabet, they have a target of achieving carbon neutrality, and in fact, even achieving carbon neutrality since their existence, what they call eliminating their carbon legacy. It only covers Scope 1 and 2 emissions.
Okay, not off to a great start, but what about the other companies in FAM?
By contrast, if you look at Microsoft and even Facebook and Apple, their commitments to achieve zero emissions over time, or net zero emissions over time, also covers Scope 3. So in that respect, you might say that they are stronger, more solid commitments.
But there are even more things to be cognizant of when it comes to emissions. Bruno said earlier about Alphabet saying they want to be carbon neutral. Carbon neutral means the company is buying carbon offsets. So a company puts a metric ton of CO2 into the atmosphere, and they pay another company not to put a ton of CO2 into the atmosphere, which means absolute emissions have still risen by a metric ton of CO2 total. And investors and the world need to move toward a future that does not have rising emissions. And to lower our emissions and thus prevent us from falling off of a climate cliff, companies or governments need to actually remove carbon from the atmosphere as well as lower their carbon footprint. That's called being carbon negative. So I asked Bruno how FAM is doing with this positive negativity and the possibility thereof.
The only one of the four that talks about being carbon negative, i.e. removing more carbon from the atmosphere than it emits, is Microsoft. And that is by 2030.
So in order to do this, Microsoft would have to remove a ton of carbon or more for every ton of carbon they emit. And to do this, they would have to use what is called carbon removal technology. But the problem is that the technology remains very expensive. And unless you're talking about planting trees, which will take about 50 plus years to get to the point where the trees are removing enough carbon from the atmosphere to be considered carbon removal technology, the technology is not yet at the stage where it can do what we would need it to do. And I can show you that by giving you an example of a upstream, downstream fossil fuel company in Spain called Repsol. Repsol had about 200 million metric tons of Scope 3 emissions in 2019 by our estimation. The established carbon capture and storage technology in 2019 can remove about 8% of that, only 25 million metric tons of carbon. So That's not bad, but it's not even close to what one upstream downstream fossil fuel company emits. But the thing is, Microsoft is very interested in this technology, as are other members of FAM, as are other companies around the world, because, as most climate scientists have told us, without the ability to remove carbon from the atmosphere, we are basically not going to slow the warming of our globe. And everyone from the World Bank to the IMF to the UN to large investment banks say that unless we do, we're going to have an economic collapse that's going to make COVID-19 pandemic look kind of like a joke. And it made me think about how investors engage with fossil fuel companies and whether or not they should continue doing that. Just kind of stop engaging with them and start engaging solely with tech companies, companies like FAM that seem to be more amenable to this change, at least aesthetically, and want to move toward a carbon negative future. I pose that question to Bruno.
So I think that's an interesting question. I think that it becomes difficult to talk about carbon removal without talking also about fossil fuel companies, because the other the other companies that we see net zero commitments from are actually the big oil and gas companies, the big energy companies. So if we look at Repsol is an example of a company that has made a net zero commitment that covers their scope 1, 2, and 3, which is a very, very big commitment. And a way to achieve this, if you're an oil and gas company, is you have to have a multi-pronged approach, which includes reducing your operational emissions, your scope 1 and 2, and then going more towards gas and less towards oil. So reducing the carbon intensity of the things you sell. But then there's a point where you need to use carbon capture and storage. And so I think that this whole net zero world is only possible in a world where we have, carbon sinks that are increasing, whether those are natural, like forests and, nature essentially working as a carbon sink, but also technological solutions. And I think that what you see now is that the companies that spent a lot of money on those carbon capture and storage and other carbon removal technologies are actually the oil and gas companies, because they know that this really means potentially the difference between continuing to exist or not continuing to exist, because what they sell is essentially carbon, right? So what they sell is products that produce CO2 when being burnt.
Okay. Well, regardless, at the end, we both agreed that governments can and might want to help grow the market for carbon capture technology, because there are companies with a lot of capital that are very interested in it, and there are a lot of humans with a lot of life left that are interested in it as well. There's a new investigation circling around the world at the moment called the FinCEN Files investigation. The FinCEN File investigation exposed 5 global banks, JPMorgan Chase, HSBC, Standard Chartered Bank, Deutsche Bank, and Bank of New York Mellon, that moved $2 trillion in U.S. dollars between 1999 and 2017 for drug cartels, corrupt regimes, arms traffickers, and other international criminals. The investigation was done by more than 400 journalists, and it drew on 2,100 suspicious activity reports, or SARs for short, that were obtained and shared by BuzzFeed News. A lot of the SARs examined were for transfers of cash that were already flagged by U.S. regulators, and some of the accused parties that have been accused of wrongdoing have denied it, and there hasn't been any trial, though some have already gone to trial. So why is it such a big deal if it's kind of already known? Well, because the investigation shows that the accused banks use their suspicious activity reports as a way to avoid any legal issues with transferring the huge sums of cash, and then they took a fee for those transfers of cash. And the banks continued to practice these illicit activities even after U.S. authorities fined them for earlier transgressions. The investigation also saw that the banks did not do enough to confirm who the cash was coming from or where it was going for half of the SARs they filed, which is a requirement for those reports. To tell me more about this controversy, I have with me Joseph Williams, who not only helps run our controversy collection team, but used to work at a bank and used to actually file those SARs report for those banks. So the first thing I wanted to know from Joseph was whether he had seen any kind of weird transactions come across his desk and what he actually did about it.
One that comes to mind was an approximately, I think it was around $80,000 wire transfer to a Nigerian bank that was being routed through a South African correspondent bank, and the purpose was for a safari big game hunt. Now, I wasn't suspicious because I'm against safari big game hunts, right? I am, but that's not the reason why I thought it was suspicious. The reason why it raised a red flag because the stated reason for going through South Africa was that the Nigerian government might confiscate the funds. Why would they confiscate the funds? The reason was never given to me. So because of this, and because of the vague answer that the government has been known to confiscate funds without cause answer I received, I created what's called a suspicious activity report, which outlines the transaction, what's suspicious about the transaction, all the parties that are involved in the transaction, and then the suspicious activity report is sent to the Financial Crimes Network, or FinCEN, which is the purpose or which is the subject of our conversation. It's these types of reports that are making up the bulk of the FinCEN files. So the process is basically once a bank submits a suspicious activity report, the Financial Crime Enforcement Network, which is what FinCEN stands for, reviews the reports and decides if any kind of action is warranted. Unless the bank has ignored established know your customer regulations, or purposely hid the transaction or details of the transaction, usually the bank is in the clear and it's on the federal investigators to take action.
Which is what seems to have happened at these banks. They had these huge sums of money come through and someone would flag it. They would say, this is suspicious. And then someone else, like Joseph, would file a SARS report and he would send it to the group that would then audit the SARS before sending it to FinCEN, the financial regulator. And then in practice, FinCEN should review it and stop the transaction. But what the FinCEN's files investigation alleges is that this did not happen. And when it did happen and red flags were raised, the reporting notes that banks seem to have ignored it. In one case, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists says that Danske Estonia bankers even ran a secret side company to get some of the illicit transactions through. And in addition to the fact that these banks were allegedly moving money for at times known terrorist groups and all-around bad guys, with these types of controversies, they're extremely internalized. It's hard to see when something is about to go wrong. So what I wanted to know from Joseph is what investors can do about these types of controversies when something like this comes out, or if they're worried about something like this coming out in the future.
So one thing that an investor can do is to take a look at penalties that have been issued by the Office of Foreign Asset Control for companies that have violated sanctions in the past. You can look at a list of when they were violated, the amount of penalty that was resulted from that violation, and also there's additional information about what safeguards the bank has put in place. The other thing that may be useful outside of the U.S. is to look at general controversies that a financial institution has faced around either money laundering, around these types of wire transfers, because there are quite a few, and any ongoing investigations that are happening that may have not been settled or may have not been finalized, but are still ongoing, and therefore the risk for penalties still exists. So it's a couple of different ways that you can look at it, but again, the difficulty is it's based on past wrongdoing, and it's hard to predict the future wrongdoing based on the past wrongdoing.
You know, Joseph, I'm kind of thinking about the labor risks now, the S of ESG with this controversy. If you were still working at a bank that was implicated in this type of controversy, what do you think it would do to your and your colleagues' morale for the ability for the bank to hire people after all this came out? Would it affect confidence in your employer, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime you have a controversy facing a company that you're working for, it absolutely takes from my perspective, it absolutely takes a toll on your confidence in the institution you're spending most of your life at. The bank that I used to work at got heavily there's a huge controversy around the mortgage crisis in late 2008, and some of the practices that the bank was performing, and that's the reason why I left. I got sick of it, and I did not want to work for a company who was abusing people, and I left. And one of the reasons why I entered the ESG space. So 100%, these types of controversies, impact employee morale.
And that's it for the week. I wanted to thank Bruno and Joseph for joining me to discuss this week's news with an ESG twist. And I wanted to thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. It always helps. And don't forget to subscribe as well. Have a great rest of the week, and I will talk to you next week.
The MSCI ESG Research podcast is provided by MSCI Inc.'s subsidiary, MSCI ESG Research LLC, a registered investment advisor under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. And this recording and data mentioned herein has not been submitted to nor received approval from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission or any other regulatory body. The analysis discussed should not be taken as an indication or guarantee of any future performance, analysis, forecast, or prediction. The information contained in this recording is not for reproduction in whole or in part without prior written permission from MSCI ESG Research. None of the discussion or analysis put forth in this recording constitutes an offer to buy or sell or a promotion or recommendation of any security, financial instrument, or product or trading strategy. Further, none of the information is intended to constitute investment advice or recommendation to make or refrain from making any kind of investment decision and may not be relied on as such. The information provided here is as is, and the user of the information assumes the entire risk of any use it may make or permit to be made of the information. Thank you.